From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start this hour with President Trump's demand yesterday that the Justice Department investigate whether the FBI infiltrated his 2016 campaign. The New York Times reported last week that an FBI informant tried to find out more about two Trump aides' ties to Russia. We've since learned the informant is an American professor at Cambridge University, who we're not naming because he was undercover. He approached Trump advisor George Papadopoulos, who's since pled guilty to lying to the FBI, and Carter Page, whose Russia connections had long put him on the FBI's radar. There is a FISA, a federal surveillance warrant, on Page that Republicans say was politically motivated because it was gained using intel from that dossier, partly paid for by the Clinton campaign. Responding to Trump's call, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein asked the DOJ's Office of the Inspector General to look into his claims. Let's bring in Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. Jonathan, Brookings Institution scholar Benjamin Wittes tweeted this morning asking whether Trump has the constitutional authority to demand an investigation of a Justice Department investigation. Your thoughts?
Well, he certainly has the constitutional authority to ask for an investigation. Whether he could force an investigation is an open question. This is highly inappropriate to have this type of demand appear through social media. It's equally inappropriate to see the president going after his own Justice Department in this way. But having said that, Rosenstein did the correct thing. Indeed, I think he should have probably acted earlier. There are legitimate concerns about an investigation that looks into key figures of an opposing party's presidential campaign. Now, in the end, this may prove to be a good faith investigation that preceded the campaign and that they acted appropriately. But I think it's a little bit strange that some people are dismissing the concerns here. I mean, the implications of this type of investigation.
By that, you mean an administration, the Obama administration in this case, starting an investigation during a campaign.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, underlying these allegations is a legitimate concern. You know, when a Democratic administration launches an investigation into a Republican campaign or figures associated with that campaign, it has troubling implications.
Well, let's talk about the figures behind this. Carter Page, there had been concerns about him all the way back to 2013 when there was no Trump campaign because of his ties to Russia. And George Papadopoulos, according to reporting in the New York Times, was drinking in a bar in 2016, and he told an Australian diplomat that Russia had political dirt on Hillary Clinton. Moscow had thousands of emails that would embarrass Mrs. Clinton. And it was only 2 months later when those Democratic emails began appearing online that the Australians passed that information on, and Mr. Papadopoulos was then questioned. At that point, you know, the interference in the American election, did the Obama administration, the Obama FBI, have any other choice?
Frankly, it's hard to tell because we don't have the full record. In terms of Carter Page, it seems clear that the investigation began before the campaign. It was unrelated to the campaign. But on the same note, what Carter Page was accused of doing, that is having this contract and all these contacts with Russians, is not that dissimilar from other people in Washington. So one of the concerns is why Page was put under such prolonged investigation and why it continued even during the campaign. Ultimately, no charges were brought against Page. They could well still be brought, mm-hmm. but they haven't been brought thus far. I think the problem here is that we don't really know all the facts. But I think that if we look at this objectively, it's hard not to conclude that there are legitimate concerns here. What the president is raising should be a concern for all citizens. That does not mean that this investigation was started for improper reasons or that it was prolonged for improper reasons. But it does indicate that it's worth looking into. And so the referral to the Inspector General's office makes a lot of sense.
Well, but as you know, the Trump administration is angry about that because they don't have prosecutorial means.
I think the administration's wrong about the objections to the Inspector General. First of all, the Inspector General is more likely to get to the bottom of this faster than would an independent investigation or the suggested commission. Second, the IG's office has been very professional, very independent, and very aggressive. I'm a little surprised that the administration is unhappy with the referral. This will get them the answer, and it will get it faster than the other options. Some of the details with regard to this professor are problematic. What really concerned me recently is the suggestions that he may have offered himself as an advisor to the campaign or actually given money to one of these aides.
And that would be infiltrating the campaign as opposed to maybe doing questioning that they felt they had to do because of Russian interference.
That's right. I mean, if indeed this asset offered to become an advisor to the campaign, it would be a very serious matter.
Okay.
I can't imagine a Department of Justice official signing off on such an extraordinary offer.
Okay. That's Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University. We'll watch as it unfolds. Jonathan, thank you.
Oh, my great pleasure.
Okay, let's go to Mexico now, where politicians are campaigning for the July 1st general election. This campaign season has been particularly violent. According to a report by the security consulting firm Adalytic, more than 90 politicians have been murdered since last September, including candidates and elected officials. As Jorge Valencia reports from KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, organized crime is threatening to dismantle the country's democratic process one election at a time.
There's a swath of southern Mexico known as hot land, or in Spanish, tierra caliente. It's an agricultural zone. Temperatures can rise up to 120 degrees, and the most prominent crop these days is opium poppy. As a result, it's wracked by violence against private citizens and against candidates for public office.
Sí, bueno.
Silvia Rivera Carvajal was running to represent part of Tierra Caliente in the state of Guerrero's Chamber of Deputies, but she recently canceled her campaign, and now she doesn't even specify where she is when she picks up the phone. On this particular day, she says she's driving from a central part of the state of Guerrero to the state capital. Perhaps more tellingly, she says she's no longer living in hot land. Rivera says people have fled their homes en masse. Even the local Coca-Cola distributor closed this spring after attacks by armed men. She says she withdrew after it became clear there were people who didn't want her to run.
It started with the people I was visiting for my campaign. They were telling me that they were being told not to vote for me, otherwise they were going to have problems. And then I got two phone calls.
The message was clear.
Well, obviously that they were going to kill me. They said it pretty directly. And so with my family, we decided that I was going to step down because it's pretty normal here that if they don't kill you, they kill your family. And my family's life is more important to me than mine.
For Bishop Salvador Rangel, the Catholic Church's overseer of Tierra Caliente, there's something else that's clear. He says democracy in Mexico is taking several steps back.
La democracia está retrocediendo en México.
In Mexico City, Professor Sandra Ley says organized crime has long tried to influence local elections. She works at the prestigious Center for Research and Teaching in Economics. And she says what's different this time around is that the violence is coinciding with this summer's presidential elections.
What we're seeing is overlap of local elections in a way that we hadn't seen in the entire electoral history in Mexico.
Ley says that when voters see violence against candidates, they participate less. She says cartels use local elections to sway, for example, the local police chief or the warden of the local jail.
This is a way in which they can begin to influence local appointments that are crucial for their own activity. So that there's a logic behind it.
For Armando Rios-Peter, a senator from Guerrero who made a failed run to be on this year's presidential ballot, the drug cartels targeting candidates have an impact on both sides of the border.
A lot of the heroin that's consumed comes from Guerrero, so we both, as countries, have a problem.
He says in the U.S., drugs are a public health issue, while in Mexico, they're an issue of public safety.
In my opinion, opium poppy should be legalized for medical use. And, of course, for recreational use, I would support legalizing marijuana.
This is not a very popular position. Rios Peter didn't even collect enough signatures to get on the ballot. A band plays at a funeral for a mayor in Tierra Caliente. He was killed just a few days after our first phone call with Silvia Rivera Carvajal, who was one of his friends.
It's too dangerous to go to Hotland right now. Things are just too mixed up right now.
Rivera didn't have to go back to Hotland for the funeral. The family held it in the state capital because their hometown is too dangerous. The election will be held on July 1st. The current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, isn't eligible for re-election. The majority of the local politicians killed are from his party. But so far, he said little about the violence. For Here Now, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
This is Here and Now. Our next two conversations are going to focus on futuristic threats, starting with something President Trump's been talking about lately.
My new national strategy for space recognizes that space is a warfighting domain, just like the land, air, and sea. We may even have a space force.
The concept of a space force goes back all the way to the beginning of the Cold War in 1947. The George W. Bush administration even floated the idea in the early 2000s. Terry Virt's been thinking about it, too. He's a former commander of the International Space Station and a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Air Force. Terry, welcome. And you've said the Air Force and the Army already have space commands that should be consolidated into a single space force. So let's start there. What kind of work is the U.S. military already doing in space?
First of all, is launching and recovering things from space. That's a big part of it. There are different types of satellites that we operate, GPS, weather and communication being some of the biggest ones. Also, there's reconnaissance satellites that we have. A big part of what Space Command does is called space situational awareness. They track objects in space and keep track of what other countries are doing in space. There's a lot of what happens in space that it directly affects combat operations in the Army or Air Force or Navy.
You know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, what does warfare in space look like?
Well, that's a good question. And this is not – another important point to make is that this is not advocating for somehow militarizing space. That happened 50 years ago, right? Yeah. That was meant – that ship has sailed. Every nation on Earth that has a significant military has some space component to it. What I'm advocating for is really making it more efficient and a more effective way to organize the military. But in the future, one of the aspects of space that the U.S. is very interested in is being able to protect and sustain our satellites in the event that the enemy might choose to try and shoot them down. In 2007, our Chinese friends had an anti-satellite weapon demonstration, and they blew up a satellite in orbit. Unfortunately, it was about the same altitude as the International Space Station. Hmm. So years later, when I was commander of the station, debris from that satellite destruction that the Chinese did was still floating up there, and we actually had to maneuver the station to avoid that. And so being able to have persistent and survivable space assets is a big part of what a Space Force would do.
How would the Space Force have intervened in a situation like that?
Well, I mean, we had Air Force Space Command. We had the Navy space component. We had the Army. So, I mean, at the time, there was a U.S. response where we demonstrated an anti-satellite weapon, but we did it at a very low-altitude satellite that came back and burned up in the Earth immediately. We didn't leave the debris up there in orbit for years. That was not a case of, you know, an aggressive action. That was just the case of, I think, flexing the muscles a little bit. Unfortunately, the problem was the debris is still in orbit years and years later.
Yeah. You've mentioned this idea that this race has already started. Major countries are already operating in space. The debate is almost moot in that way. But there are people who are very critical of the U.S. military presence on Earth. You know, we have service members dying in Iraq and Afghanistan, in Africa. I mean, what would you say to critics who don't want to see the military spreading its footprint any further?
Well, again, you yourself said it. The space is already a part of our military. To somehow remove all military satellites from space, I don't think is realistic. It would certainly really hurt our forces down here on the ground. So that's not something that's going to happen. I think the debate that we're having right now is not about increasing somehow weaponizing further space. It's about really the best way to organize our forces. I think having Space Command as part of the Air Force, in my mind, is kind of like having the infantry be a subcommand of the Navy.
How quickly would it take to get a Space Force operating?
Well, it would be a government operation, so it would not happen overnight. The Air Force became the Air Force in 1947, 2 years after the end of World War II. I would imagine it would be maybe a two-year type of transition. You know, the time is as good now as ever.
Terry Virts is a former commander of the International Space Station, a retired U.S. Air Force pilot, and an advocate to create a Space Force in the military. Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And there may be a day when the U.S. government uses a 3D printer to make the tools it needs to operate in space. That same technology could also be used to make sophisticated bombs and weapons, or allow rogue regimes to avoid international sanctions. That's one of the conclusions in a new paper published by RAND, and we're joined now by one of its authors, Associate Economist Troy Smith. Troy, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. It's nice to be here.
This technology has been around for, quite a few years now. Why did you and your colleagues think that it was time to take a fresh look at some of these security concerns?
That's a great question. Yeah, it really got developed in the 1980s. The difference is now that a lot of the patents have expired. And so what the technology has been able to do and how it's being used is expanding like it hasn't in the past.
And we've been hearing about some of these possible threats for years, ever since the technology gets started. For instance, guns and weapons. Put that into context. Is that a real threat?
Yeah, so guns are already fairly cheap and readily available in places like the United States. So we don't think that guns, at least in the United States, is a very big threat. However, other types of weapons, so if we're thinking of things like attack drones or bioterrorism weapons or explosives, those could be more problematic in the United States. The other thing that changes with this technology is you no longer have point-of-cell restrictions. Those are just not effective anymore.
Right. So there's no background check, for instance. If somebody prints a gun, nobody knows the gun even exists.
Exactly. And so people that we might not want to have these weapons will be able to get access to them. So that will change. One other thing that might be different is, right now, if you go into a secure building, you can't take a weapon with you. Whereas once this technology advances, all you need is a digital blueprint and access to a printer, and you could have a gun in a place like an airport or a secure government facility. The technology is not there yet, but it could be pretty quickly.
Well, we're looking at this report from 2016. The TSA found a printed gun in a carry-on bag at the airport in Reno, Nevada. So it's not all hypothetical at this point.
That's right. Yeah. So, and that gun was printed out of plastic, and according to the maker, couldn't be fired. But yes, these things are coming up already.
All right. So tell us what else you're worried about. One concern you have is that hackers could sabotage industrial printers and alter the designs of products, design them to actually fail.
Yeah, that's right. So this technology is being used for things like airplane parts and other things that we really depend on to be made well. So a team actually from Johns Hopkins in June 2016, they hacked into the computer, changed a little design on a propeller for a drone. It was undetectable. The drone flew for about a minute and 43 seconds before the propeller shattered and the drone kind of fell to the ground. Hmm. So that's the kind of thing that we would be worried about in the ability to insert these flaws into these mechanical products.
So tiny, you wouldn't even notice until it was too late.
That's right. Yeah, now we have the ability for digital to become physical, and so little design flaws can make a big difference in critical parts.
Well, you point out also that it's not just people who might abuse this technology. Countries might be able to do it. Now, this is fascinating. You say a country like North Korea could print parts for a nuclear weapon to get around international sanctions, for example. Now, it's, of course, very timely as we talk about President Trump going to meet with the North Korean leader. But you're saying that countries could get around sanctions by printing the things they can't get shipped in otherwise.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, so A good example is Iran, which is also pretty timely right now. So in January 2017, they had a delivery of an Airbus A321, Iran's first new Western-made aircraft in several decades. So Iran Air has traditionally been pretty unreliable. Some of the passengers even referred to it in terms of flying coffins because they couldn't get these parts from the West because of sanctions. So with 3D printing, now you can print these parts, obsolescent parts or parts that you can't get elsewhere, and potentially get around these sanction regimes, which means that the United States and other Western powers will have much less control in these areas.
We've been talking about the downsides of this technology, but look, there are also huge benefits. I'm thinking in manufacturing and healthcare. I mean, do you think that the technology is a net gain despite these risks?
Definitely. We definitely think that it's a net positive, and that's one of the things that we're kind of worried about. We wanted to start this conversation of potential security risks so that we could start thinking about them now and address them so that we can get to the positive benefits of the technology. But one thing that we're worried about is if there's a danger in overreacting, overregulating, and smothering what could be a new era of innovation.
Yeah, I mean, because some of these threats that you're talking about are kind of scary. You could see people reacting to them. But how do we keep ourselves safe from some of the things you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question, and an area where we think that we need a lot more research. You could do controls on kind of printing materials. You could do registration of printers. You could build digital signatures into the items that are printed. So at least you could attribute it to the source once it has been printed. There's also, in terms of the flaws, there's a team that they actually create an algorithm to listen to the printers as they're printing to see whether any flaws were being printed into the products that they were printing. So that's a potential promising area of research as well.
Wow. You're saying a minuscule difference in the sound of the printer could be picked up and then give a clue that it might have been hacked.
Yeah, that's what a team from Rutgers and Georgia Tech, that's actually what they found in their research.
That's Troy Smith, an associate economist at RAND and the co-author of a new paper on some of the growing security concerns around 3D printing. Troy, thank you.
Thank you.
And tomorrow is not just Tuesday, it is Tom Waits Tuesday, at least according to an artist in Denver named Travis Hetman. He is obsessed with the lovely and guttural singer-songwriter Tom Waits. Colorado Public Radio's Stephanie Wolf explains.
Travis Hetman says the first time he heard Tom Waits, he was not impressed.
I was a young punk rock kid.
Hetman was 14 when he was listening to a punk rock compilation from the 90s called Punk-O-Rama, and it had a Waits song on it.
And I remember just hearing that and thinking that just, this guy sounds really weird. I'll just skip this song.
That song was Waits' 1999 hit Big in Japan from his album Mule Variations.
Got the grace, got the clothes, not the face.
Now that's like one of my favorite songs in existence, but at the time it is funny to think back all those years that I was listening to this weird gravelly voice and thought, don't care for that.
It was Waits' 11th album, Rain Dogs, that was the gateway for Hetman.
Inside a broken clock.
And then that just blew the doors open.
Hetman was in a Minneapolis band then, and his bandmate gave him a copy of Rain Dogs. This was 7 years after his initial tepid introduction. Hetman says listening to that record was transportive, but his obsession with Waits was, quote, a slow burn.
Really what does it is getting to know the entire length of this artist's career and seeing, like, oh my gosh, this person is constantly reinventing himself as an artist. And really it's like the variety and progression of his total scope.
Hetman is drawn to what he sees as Waits' masterful blending of darkness and tenderness.
Get further and further into this hole with Tom Waits, like the more you listen to it, the more you realize how brilliant it is from a poetry perspective.
These days, Hetman says a lot of his artwork features Tom Waits. The musician first showed up in a drawing 5 years ago, Hetman says he had the 1941 Orson Welles classic Citizen Kane on his mind.
I made no campaign promises because until a few weeks ago, I had no hope of being elected.
Then Hetman found a photo of Waits as a kid.
I just instantly had the image in my head of Citizen Kane propaganda poster, but instead of Kane, it's Tom Waits as a child, as if some movement had begun to try to get Tom into office as a child. It's just one of those weird, really strange ideas that I just drew it instead of thinking about it too much.
That inspired Hetman to create Tom Waits Tuesday. He posts a Waits drawing on his Instagram every Tuesday. The first person to call dibs gets to buy it. Sometimes Hetman's art sells within seconds, and the buyers are from all over the country. In the boiler room, the poor, the lame, the blind. Hetman says he's never heard from Waits.
There's no one I'd rather hear from or have the chance to, like, run into. But I don't know if I'd want it to be because I've been, like, doing drawings related to him. You'd want to run into Tom Waits, like, randomly on the street.
The Denver artist promised he'd let us know if Waits does ever reach out. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Wolf in Denver.
Tom Waits, call us. It's Here and Now.
Sports franchise owners, casinos, those fantasy game sites where players form teams and compete, are some of the big winners after the Supreme Court overturned a federal ban on sports betting last week, allowing states to decide how and if they want to legalize it. But are the losers future gambling addicts? Problem gambling already impacts an estimated 2 million Americans a year. Our two guests today say if it's going to be legalized outside Vegas, put in speed bumps like betting limits, training for casinos, tracking data. Leah Naur is director of the Center for Gambling Studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey, the state that sued to legalize sports gambling. Her research found that most sports bettors in New Jersey are 18 to 34 years old. Half of them gamble once a week or more. Almost two-thirds of them are at high risk of becoming addicted. Hi, Leah.
Hello.
And we also have Michael Burke, executive director of the Michigan Association on Problem Gambling, but he's a board member of the nonprofit National Council on Problem Gambling, author of Never Enough, One Lawyer's True Story of How He Gambled His Career Away, and that lawyer would be him. Mike, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And Leah, I want to start with you. When we talk about sports betting, we're talking about placing bets on games online and maybe increasingly at casinos, racetracks, maybe at the corner store. Your immediate thoughts?
My immediate thoughts are that based on studies that we've done, these folks that gamble on sports tend to gamble more often and have more problems than the average gambler. So you have to have safeguards in place, which we do have online, but not necessarily at racetracks.
Well, the National Council on Problem Gambling, Mike, that's you. These are some of the concerns that your organization has. You want some of these safeguards in place. Like what?
What we're asking for is that the states start to pony up money to take care of the problems that are going to result because of this increase in gambling. We know that whenever there's an expansion of legalized sports gaming in the United States, there will be an increase in gambling participation, which also means we know that there will be an increase in gambling problems. In all the states that are going to legalize sports betting, we hope will be responsible stewards and help to take care of the problems that are going to exist.
So you're talking about ensuring that any expansion of sports gambling includes dedicated funds to prevent or treat gambling addictions. Sports betting shouldn't even be allowed in a state without funding for problem gambling services. Leah, is this the kind of thing you're talking about as well, preemptively trying to fund care for the problem that you see in the future?
Yes, a lot of legislation throws money at treatment. And my experience has been that by the time people need treatment, there's already a lot of devastation.
So players should be able to maybe set weekly or monthly deposit, loss, win, and time limits prior to gambling. This is something else that's been suggested by your group, Mike, the Council on Problem Gambling. Almost set up a system where players regulate themselves, and if they go over, there's some tripwire?
Yes, and I was in Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago speaking at the state gambling conference. And one of the groups that also spoke was MGM Grand Casino and Hotel. They talked about their new GameSense program. They come in, they help their clients set limits as far as the amount of time they gamble and the amount of money they spend. They're taking a really big step to help people get assistance before they get into the later stages of problem gambling.
But I'm wondering, Mike, share with us some of your story, because it seems so compulsive at a certain point that compulsive, addicted gamblers will do end runs around whatever limits are in place. You were stealing from your clients. You were a successful lawyer representing people, and you were taking their money to try to pay back your debt.
I probably had gambled 14 or 15 years. I'd go out to Vegas once a year. We did not have gambling in Michigan at that time, except for the lottery. And my downfall was proximity. They opened a casino in Windsor that was less than an hour from Howell, where I lived. I found that I started going over a couple days a week, spending what I thought was a reasonable amount of money, up to $300. I set the limits, I maintained them. But what happened is down the road, of course, that changes, and I start chasing the money I've lost. And I actually ended up embezzling $1.6 million from my clients. And I spent 3 to 10 years as a result of this in Jackson Prison.
Yeah. Look, you write, gamblers lose. They must lose. That's how the house functions. If there's a game that gamblers are winning too much at, they take it away. What would have happened to you if there was online betting? You talk about proximity.
It's really hard for me to tell, because about the time that my life exploded was a time that this was all starting up. And we talk about the proximity model being around 50 miles, that if you're a person who's predisposed to having a gambling problem, that 50 miles is a limit when they open a new venue where a person is predisposed to a gambling problem, those problems will double.
Well, Leo, what do you do? What do you anticipate? You talk about trying to have these preventive speed bumps. Are you concerned that, you know, there will be people like Michael who just, it's so diluted, I mean, that he would steal from clients?
I mean, I do a lot of work with gamblers who are charged with crimes, and that's not uncommon. What I'm concerned about is that we don't have these preventative mechanisms and accountability in the places like racetracks. Casinos have a long history with like self-exclusion programs. Some work more than others, but if the states don't require evaluation and accountability like we have in New Jersey for online, there's no way to find out if these people really do have these resources. So that's my primary worry, particularly at a racetrack where you go there to bet on a horse, and then you're betting on sports, and then you're doing it on your cell phone. The more things you do, the more likely you're to get yourself underwater.
And so, just again, what are some of the speed bumps you'd like to see?
I would like to see a standardized protocol for educating people on what options there are to set their limits. And I would like to see whoever offers the sports betting, that a percentage be dedicated not just to treatment, but also to evaluating the outcomes of these responsible gaming programs every year. Meaning that the venues have to keep the data, and then the data is evaluated on who is playing, who is opting for these different limit setting mechanisms, how are they working, and how can we improve them, so that it's a very dynamic system aimed at harm reduction.
Boy, that gets into some privacy issues, though, doesn't it? I mean, if casinos know when somebody's regularly going over the limit that they've set for themselves, what do you do? Contact the family? I mean, what do you do?
There's a lot of different countries and states that have different ways of dealing with this. Some people use pop-ups. I mean, in a sports arena, understand that these casinos all know what people are spending. Mm. And that's what's used for marketing purposes to get them to spend more money.
Yeah.
And so they can use this for good, to help educate the person. Hey, you set this limit for yourself. You then took it off. Now you're 3 times your limit. Would you like to set this again? Would you like to look at this again?
Mike, would that have helped you?
I definitely think so. But I will tell you, I have a very strong feeling about how we can do the most good. And that is to go into substance abuse treatment centers and start mandating that they do more educating to their clients about not trading their substance abuse addiction for a gambling addiction. And that is exactly what I did.
What, did you go from abuse of alcohol maybe to gambling?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I stopped drinking 40 years ago. But what I did is I traded it for another addiction.
Yeah.
I never got involved in drugs after my treatment because the people at the treatment center terrified me about trading an alcohol addiction for a drug addiction.
But nobody terrified you about trading it for gambling?
No.
That's Michael Burke, executive director now of the Michigan Association on Problem Gambling, but a recovering gambler, as we just heard, and Leah Naur, director of the Center for Gambling Studies at Rutgers University. I want to thank you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robin, thank you very much.
And your thoughts, would a pop-up warning on your computer screen keep you from going over your limit? And your thoughts in general on the legalization of sports gambling are welcome at hereandnow.org.
The Dow jumped more than 350 points this morning after Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said yesterday that the U.S. was putting a trade war with China on hold. This morning, he walked that back a little on CNBC.
This has been a trade dispute all along. It never was a trade war. It's a trade dispute on significant issues. Both parties have agreed to suspend the tariffs are
Mnuchin is referring to the $200 billion in tariffs that the U.S. and China have threatened against each other. Let's bring in Derek Thompson. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us now, as he does each Monday, from New York. Hey, Derek, good to have you back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Sure. So, you know, Wall Street seems to like what Mnuchin had to say over the last 24 hours or so, but what happened to the White House being tough on China? Why put a hold on these tariffs?
Yeah, there are two reasons, I think, why the White House would put a hold on these tariffs with China. Reason number one is that the tariffs were a real bargaining chip, but we had to take them off the table because negotiations weren't going very well. The U.S. Is asking for concessions that China simply isn't willing to offer. Reason number two, though, is that the tariffs were never a real bargaining chip. We were never going to apply these tariffs in the first place. Huh. Because although Trump has tweeted and talked about them, he's surrounded by economic advisors, Steve Mnuchin, we just heard from, the Treasury Secretary, but also Larry Kudlow, director of the NEC and former CNBC primetime star. These guys don't want a trade war. Mm-hmm. These guys want to do just enough to placate the president's populist impulses while keeping trade flowing. So, again, there's two reasons, but there's no clear reason to think that these tariffs were going to happen in the first place.
And about those advisors, around the time Mnuchin said that the tariffs would be suspended, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer said that tariffs still remain a valuable tool. And there are some people wondering if there is not some messaging disconnect among the White House staff there.
Well, of course there's a messaging disconnect. I mean, I think I joked last week or the week before that the president is not a member of his own White House. The president is his own institutional body, and then the White House often crafts policy that it's in direct response to his tweeted preferences. Right now, we don't have a unified government that's negotiating with China. We have the president, who tweets from time to time. We have a trade representative who seems to agree with him. We have a Treasury secretary who doesn't seem to agree with the trade representative. Then we have an NEC director, a top economic advisor, who often sides with the Treasury secretary, but sometimes goes on television to say that he agrees with the president. This is not how you negotiate. You don't negotiate by taking seven different stances and then asking your negotiating counterparties to pick one to fight back against. You present a unified front. And the United States doesn't have a unified front in trade policy, just as we often don't have a unified front in other domestic policies. We have instead a kind of day-to-day, week-to-week attempt to craft policy that meets the predilections of various members of this White House.
Okay, let's talk about what what might possibly come out of a deal if they can hash one out. The U.S. is pushing China to buy $200 billion of American goods, and that would reduce the trade gap between the two countries. The number seems to be in dispute now. It kind of has vanished off the negotiating table, but it's a huge part of the deal. That trade deficit bothers the president very much. How would it work in theory?
Well, to be quite honest, it probably wouldn't work in theory. Any attempt to get China to buy $200 billion of extra U.S. goods, of U.S. goods on top of their annual purchases every single year. Let's be clear about exactly what an extra $200 billion would mean.
A lot of money.
So $200 billion is about 700 Boeing airplanes. Hmm. Last year, Boeing made 763. So you're talking about buying more than 90% of Boeing's annual output, going to just one country, China. Literally, Boeing would only be able to sell, five dozen extra airplanes to the rest of the world. Mm. If China bought all of the United States' agricultural exports, that would only get you three quarters of the way to $200 billion. So the direct answer to the question, how exactly would it work in theory for China to buy an extra $200 billion in U.S. goods, is that it can't really work in theory. And so at best, you could say this is the kind of bargaining chip that the White House is putting forward in order to demonstrate, to show how serious they are about accomplishing other trade-related goals with regard to China.
Well, in fact, the president tweeted today that under the terms of the deal that China will purchase from our great American farmers practically as much as our farmers can produce, which I think doesn't that kind of hint at exactly what you're saying? I mean, that's putting the farmers at capacity. Who else will they produce for?
Total U.S. agricultural exports are $138 billion. We're trying to raise, according to the White House, we're trying to raise China's annual imports from the U.S. by $200 billion, which means that literally if every single thing that farmers of the United States sell to other countries, if all of it go to China, we're still $62 billion short. Mm. Now, look, there are a lot of critics of the president's trade policy, but it's important to state before we go that there's a really important issue at the bottom of this, and that is intellectual property.
Right.
This has been the subject of a U.S. investigation. There's this idea that China forces American businesses to hand over their most valuable tech in exchange for access to the Chinese market. This is a sketchy move. We should do everything that we can in order to make sure that China stops doing this, stops essentially asking for piracy in order to have access. That should be the bottom line, though, here, not the $200
billion. And the White House says it is pushing for that. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.